That's the worst Christmas.
Hello, and welcome to episode 19 of If This Is a Podcast, Then What's Christmas? If you can hear some noise in the background, that would be the incredibly massive storm that's going on in LA today. This is Friday, the somethingth of February. And today, I'm just absolutely honoured to be speaking to Mark Romanek. He's a proper pucker Hollywood director, which is very exciting for me. I hope it's very exciting for you too. But, you know, he's directed so many fantastic commercials. If you look on the blog, I've put a lot of them up. He's directed even more, probably, fantastic music videos. He has won more Grammys for short form music video than any other director. His videos have won over 20 MTV awards. He's good at this. But he also made two really fantastic movies. He's made three movies. I haven't seen the third one, so I can't really tell you about Static, but we do talk about that a little bit. But One Hour Photo is brilliant, and Never Let Me Go, I think, in my opinion, even better. So, you know, he's created a lot of really, really amazing work in the audiovisual media, but also, you know, just because you're great at one of those things doesn't mean you're going to be great at another. So for him to really have been so good, or as good as he has been in commercials, videos and movies, I think is remarkable. And I was, you know, honored to have an hour of his time. So without further ado, here's my chat with Mark.
Yeah, so like I said, thanks so much for making the time to chat to me. That's
very kind of you. Sure, no problem.
So I've watched a huge amount of your stuff over the last week or two, understandably. And I found some really interesting things. So I was just going to ask you about a couple of them, particularly from the beginning of your time as a filmmaker. And you mentioned individually that you found 2001 and Mary Poppins to both be really big influences on you. So what parts of those two films were really kind of set you off on your path, do you think?
So I'm not sure that I ever thought about it, comparing them, but now that you mention it, one of the things seems to me that they were completely contrived worlds, pretty much built from the ground up. Or maybe not pretty much. I mean, I don't think there's any location work in any of those films, other maybe than the background plates of the Dawn of Man sequence or something, but you know, everything was created, and it exists in a designed universe that has sort of one foot in a certain amount of authenticity or reality, and a good deal of it is it just exists in the designed mind of the filmmaker who designed these worlds. So I guess that left a big impression that my first exposure to cinema was not cinema verite or location, you know, neorealism or something. They were these studio concoctions.
I guess 2001 as a 9-year-old is quite an interesting movie, because my son's 10 right now, and I don't think I could quite get him into that at the moment. So I don't know if there was a part of 2001, because it has some quite discrete sequences. Do you think that there was a certain particular element of 2001 that really hit you?
I think my father took me half because he maybe didn't have a babysitter and half because he thought maybe as a 9-year-old boy I would be turned on by the spaceships or something. You know, I'm not sure my father knew what he was in for when he took me, because the film was so radical. I'm not sure that he even knew what it was going to be. But, I mean, if you think about it, it's a great film for a child to see, because it's so kind of, it's so imagistic, and it's not really reliant on language. And so for a child whose language isn't particularly well-developed, it's sort of the perfect visual grammar for a child in a way. And, you know, plenty of adults couldn't really understand it. So one could argue that a child might understand it better because they don't come with as many preconceptions. But, I mean, it, you know, the images are so powerful. They're still resonating through the pop culture even today. So yeah, they hit me really, really hard. And I remember the experience like it was yesterday. And I remember the apes, and I remember the apes finding the monolith and touching it, and I remember the spaceships floating, circling with the Strauss music, and I remember the trip sequence, and I remember the old man in the room. Like, those are indelible things to a child or an adult, those images.
Yeah, absolutely. And I've read a few articles about, you know, people storming out when adults, as you said, when the first screenings happened. So I think maybe you're right there that, you know, you didn't perhaps have the baggage that adults have in terms of appreciating it as a child. So
yeah, there's a famous anecdote about a MGM executive storming out of the first screening saying, well, that's the end of Stanley Kubrick.
Little did he know. Yeah. And then as a kid, you went on to be one of those kids. I mean, we read about them occasionally. Spielberg's definitely one of them, who went on to make lots of sort of little movies when they were sort of at a young age. So did your parents encourage you to go down that path?
Yeah, my father was a camera buff, and he built me a darkroom when I was 12 years old because his uncle had done that for him, and he bought me a nice camera when I was 12. And so he was very supportive of my interest, and he loved movies too. He was a real estate developer, so he wasn't necessarily making his living in a strictly creative or fine arts way, but he was very open to it. So I ended up working one summer as a camp counselor in order to pay for a Super 8 camera, and started making Super 8 films.
Yeah, and you did your degree in cinema and photography. So when you were at school, were you sort of trying to aim things in that direction already? Because a lot of people don't know what they want to do when they're a teenager. But
I was extremely lucky because at the age of, I think, 15, and again, I almost remember the exact moment, I went, wait a second, I want to do this. This is going to be my thing. And I knew that it wasn't a fickle thing like, I want to be an astronaut or I want to be a fireman and the next week it's something else. I had this really strong sense that this was it. So, I was incredibly fortunate in other ways too, because I went to a very progressive public high school in, near Chicago called New Trier East. It was very academically advanced, and this was, the mid-70s, so it was still a bit the hippie kind of sensibilities. And they had a four-year film production and theory program in a public high school in the suburbs of Chicago, which is super weird. And not only that, but they staffed that department, such as it was, with two teachers. But from the Art Institute of Chicago, which was a bastion of avant-gardism. And so those teachers were teaching us really trippy, mind-blowing avant-garde cinema at a really impressionable age. Now, what are the odds of this? You know, when I read that Malcolm Gladwell book, Outliers, I realized how lucky I was that I was ticking a lot of the boxes that he outlined, and that was definitely a big box that got ticked. Was I was had early exposure to very mind-expanding ideas of what cinema could be, like Stan Brakhage films and Jonas Mekas and Michael Snow and Kenneth Anger, and really wild stuff. It was pretty subversive, if you think about it, of those teachers to do that, because, this is a pretty conservative suburban area.
Yeah, that sounds like that would be a pretty unique education to sort of set you off, particularly, I guess, in the, when are we talking about, the sort of late 70s, early 80s, when, there was a lot of means?
I'm older than that, so this was mid-70s.
Oh, mid-70s. Yeah. Well, that was a great time for cinema. It was the middle of the Easy Riders, Raging Bulls kind of era. So that must have been a pretty fascinating time to want to get into cinema as a medium that was being taken very seriously at that point, I think, in an intellectual way.
Well, I mean, again, I was exposed to the whole spectrum of what cinema was capable of being, because at school they were showing us Mothlight and Dog Star Man and stuff by Ken, you know, Stan Brakhage, and then on the weekend I would see Jaws and Star Wars and Dog Day Afternoon and, you know, that golden era of American and foreign cinema. So it was a really, really fertile, good time to decide I'm interested in filmmaking. Very lucky.
Yeah, absolutely. And you had some contact with Brian De Palma at this point. I was wondering if you could talk about how you managed to sort of get into working with him, because it seemed like you sort of not forced it, but you kind of made sure that opportunity was not going to go past you.
Well, you know, because I had such an advanced film education as a teenager, because these guys, and the teacher's name specifically, by the way, were Kevin Dole and Peter Kingsbury. They not only taught us theory by showing us these films, but they subscribed to this sort of Bible of independent cinema, a book called The Independent Filmmaker, which was really nuts and bolts. I mean, they were teaching us about film emulsions and editing on A and B rolls and lenses and optics and different camera systems. And, you know, so it was amazing. So the point is, to answer your question, is that I had received such an amazing education in cinema already by the age of about 17 that I started to think, okay, now what can I do next? And the next thing was, can I get on a movie set? But I lived in Chicago. I didn't live in L.A. or New York, so there weren't a ton of films. But coincidentally, that summer, there was a film coming to be shot in Chicago called The Fury, and it was directed by Brian De Palma, and it would star John Cassavetes, who I also, even at that young age, knew about his films and knew who he was. And so I asked my father, who was a successful real estate developer, I said, do you know anyone in the film business so I can get on a movie set? And he said, yeah, I do, actually. I know this lawyer who arranges tax shelters for film financing. And he asked the guy, you know, can you get my son on a film set? And he said, yeah, let me find out. And he wrote a letter to John Cassavetes, who he knew, and I got a job on this film. And I met the producer, Frank Yablons, and I said, hey, I'm Bert Cantor's friend. And oh, he said, oh, yeah, yeah, I remember that letter. Yeah, yeah, well, just hang around and help out, kid. So instead of, you know, so he didn't really give me anything specific to do. So being a reasonably intelligent kid, I said, I'm not going to hang around craft service. I'm going to hang around the director. He told me to hang around. Yeah. I'm going to hang around Brian De Palma. So I introduced myself to Brian De Palma. I was a nervy kid, you know. And he said, and I said, if there's anything I could do for you, I'm around here to help. And he said, yeah, I'd like a coffee, two creams, two sugars. So I became like his coffee boy in a way. And I moved his chair around for each new setup. And this was the early days of video assist. And so I was able to watch what they were shooting on the video monitors. And slowly, you know, he saw that I was a, you know, sincere kid and I was really interested. And he started explaining things to me and asking me questions like, you know, who are you? What are you interested in? And he, you know, he was quite a nice guy in the sense that it was a pretty technical film, as I guess a lot of his films maybe were. And so there was a lot of time between setups, and I would have these long chats with him and ask questions, and he answered me. And we kind of became, I wouldn't say friends, but, you know, he became a mentor in that way. I also had some nice conversations with John Cassavetes, who was very, very nice. And, you know, so, you know, I was a pig in shit. I felt like I had, you know, sort of crossed the velvet rope to the other side of where I was inside now, and I was finding out how things were done.
Do you think there's anything specific you took from your time, you know, in contact with Brian De Palma?
I mean, I would say that if you want to visit a film set because you're interested to learn about filmmaking, and your first time on a film set, and you're lucky enough to have the quote unquote job of hanging around and helping out by the director, it's basically you're awash in information. You don't know anything about how films are made, feature professional Hollywood feature films are made, and now you're seeing everything. You're seeing how they set up the cameras and how they choose lenses, and when they use two cameras, where do they position them, and how does the sound guy work, and what kind of mic is it, and how does the director talk to actors, and when they get in arguments about stuff, what are the arguments about, and how do they do the light? I mean, so to answer your question, I was drowning in information about just how things are done. I mean, it was too much to take in, but I observed and took in what I could. And the difference between, making some 16mm films or Super 8 films on your own and seeing how it's done professionally at a very high level, is beyond, I can't calculate how much I learned.
Yeah, I think when I was watching one of your, maybe it was the Making of the Closer video, you said something along the lines of directing is a state of continual crisis management. Do you think that's it? There's lots of, you're either juggling lots of balls or putting out lots of fires, or is that what it's like?
Well, I mean, at that stage, perhaps that's how I would have described it, because I'm, even at that stage, I'm still learning not only the technical side of filmmaking, but the more intangible people relationship gestalt kind of process. I'd say now it's less and less crisis management because I've done more. I'm more confident, and I'm much more confident in allowing the collaborators to express themselves, and you start to only direct, quote unquote, when it's necessary, whether that means talking to the cameraman about moving the camera or talking to the talent about altering their behavior. Now I only do it when it's strictly necessary, and I sort of try to let things flow and stay out of the way of it a little more, but that just comes with, experience.
Absolutely.
Certainly crises arise, yeah. And but it's not continual crisis management. And plus, I was trying to just sound dramatic and interesting, probably.
Yeah. I think perhaps unusually, the thing you broke in with was a feature film. How did you get to, do something quite so substantial as one of your first, proper things to have as a calling card?
Well, I went to school in Ithaca, New York, at Ithaca College, but a lot of my friends were going to Cornell, and one of them was a theater student who was very interesting, and he, when he left college, we stayed friends, but he became an investment banker, kind of in the glory days of, kind of Wall Street and that 80s yuppie money thing, and he kept an interest in the arts and in theater, and he said, and he made a lot of money for his bank, I think, so he said, he called me up one day and said, I think I could get an unsecured loan for about $1 million to make an independent movie, because it almost is a bonus for the work well done at his bank. And this coincided with, there was a kind of a movement of independent cinema that was happening in New York. I moved to New York City at this point, where people like Spike Lee and Jim Jarmusch and some others were making independent movies in New York. And I said, well, let me write a script and let's do this. So I had become friends with Keith Gordon through my relationship with Brian De Palma, who was a young actor at the time. He was in Christine and some other films. And we wrote a script together. And sure enough, my friend from Cornell was correct. And he managed to get an unsecured loan for $1 million to make an independent film. So we kind of made up a story as quickly as we could and just went out and made this movie. And frankly, I didn't have any idea what I was doing. I mean, for all of what I just described about learning about feature filmmaking and seeing independent avant-garde cinema and all this stuff and making a couple Super 8 films, to actually be a director on a million-dollar movie when you're 23 years old, that proved to be, getting thrown into the swimming pool into the deep end. Without any swimming lessons, and I got through it, but I don't think it's any good, and I kind of learned that I don't know what I'm doing, and I said, you know, next time I do this, I don't want to feel like that again. I don't want to feel like I'm faking it. And I don't want to feel like I'm constantly in over my head. The next time I make a movie, I want to at least have the beginnings of a sense of that I know what I'm doing. And so that was that story, yeah.
Yeah, when I tried to track down Static, it was pretty difficult to find. I didn't find it. But the interesting thing was the YouTube comments on whatever clip I found, they were very complimentary. People saying that I just saw this once at a film festival and it's just stayed with me forever and blah, blah, blah. And then there were lots of other comments saying that you personally had a hand in it not really being available. Is that the case?
Yeah, both of those things are true. I mean, the film played in only for a couple of weeks in New York and L.A. At the Film Forum and the New Art. But in London, and I think in Australia and in Spain, the film was, you know, by any objective standard, a real cult hit. It played in London, I remember, for like 4 months in one cinema. And so you run into people that saw it and liked it. I find it embarrassing, you know. And so I'm not actively, like, suppressing it, but I'm very happy that it's not easy to see because I find it a kind of a piece of juvenile, it's a little embarrassing for me.
And was that desire to sort of know what you were doing in your next job part of what led you into the world of music videos rather than, say, trying to do another movie?
Yeah, definitely. I wasn't going to jump into another movie right away. And the film wasn't perceived as successful. It got trounced in the New York Times by Janet Maslin. And I always thought, like, why are we so riled up about this little movie? Like, she really hated it. And so I wasn't really in a position probably to make another movie anyway. But what happened was, in another good bit of good luck, I used a bunch of pop music as the score for the movie, and because we couldn't really afford to get a composer or anything of any quality. And one of the people who I used their song in the movie, he asked me to make a music video. And I never, MTV was, you know, had started up, I think, but it wasn't like the big cultural phenomenon that it became in its heyday. And I never had any thought to make a music video. It wasn't like on the radar of something to do. But he said, would you make a music video? And I said, okay. And I kind of came up with an idea. He had a pretty good budget in those days. It was like $35,000. And, it was 35,000 pounds, actually.
Wow.
So that's that was probably like about $50,000, which is a lot back then.
Yeah.
And I came up with this idea, and I shot the video, and everybody really liked it, and it came out really well. And I think what happened was a lot of my early exposure to that avant-garde cinema kind of came to fruition. If it planted a seed in my brain, you know, because music video making at the time and still is a very free-form kind of medium. It's very, people like it when it's avant-garde and weird. And so, the video was kind of successful and a light bulb went off and I went, wait a second, I just actually got paid to be a filmmaker. And it was fun and people liked it. Maybe this is how maybe I'll just do this for a while and I can get that confidence that I felt was missing when I made Static, about the technique of filmmaking and the technical side of filmmaking and working with the crews and the talent. And maybe I can do this for a while until I feel I've gained the confidence to make another film. And the goal was always to make another film. I never really wanted to be a music video director as a career.
And so I think I've definitely heard of some directors doing this, but were you taking the subsequent videos that you were making and using them to kind of explore your art and kind of giving you things to take on into maybe the next movie?
I don't think I was thinking about it as something to use in movies because I did in my mind make a distinction between music videos and movies and there was very little overlap in terms of what could be useful to make a successful music video and a successful movie unless you just wanted to make some strange, weird you know, movie that didn't have any sort of narrative sense. So I tried to just, at a certain point, I realized if, in order to be good at this and get more and better opportunities, I have to do a good job for the artist and the label. It's not so much about what I can get out of it. It's about how do I make a successful music video in its own right so that maybe the next one will be a bigger budget or a more prestigious artist. And so I think I had such a rough time making Static that I pretty much set aside the notion of making another movie for at least 5 years. And I said, let me just get good at this, you know, and then whatever I learn from it, I'll find out, you know, as I go.
Yeah, and I'm really interested in people who direct promos. I often wonder, is it the song that attracts them, or what exactly is it that makes them take on a certain job? The band, the song, the time of life? What was it for you?
Well, in the beginning, you take on almost anything because you want to build a reel. And unless the music is truly awful, I would try to get the job and make the best of it. You know, I remember that, you know, some songs seemed complete and in, you know, that adding visuals to it wasn't going to make it a better experience to hear the song. And then other songs, which is more common maybe, they're kind of, you know, sketchy and half-baked, and not necessarily in a negative way, but, and that left room to attach visuals to them so that it became symbiotic, where the visuals and the music somehow became a new thing that was, you know, maybe greater. Some songs don't really have interesting, they're not trucking with interesting ideas or themes. And so you can't really think of much interesting because it's not, they're not singing about anything particularly interesting. So it would vary from you know, song to song.
Yeah, and I guess the one that really made a huge difference to, I guess, the way you're perceiving your career was Closer, and that is one where the visuals really, really enhanced the song and vice versa. Did you feel when you were making it that this was going to be something that was something different in terms of how, you know, how big you would become or how people would perceive you?
Well, it was kind of a perfect situation to do something, you know, noticeable, because, you know, Nine Inch Nails was really peaking, and people's interest in Nine Inch Nails was peaking, and, you know, this song was, the chorus of the song was, I want to fuck you like an animal. No song in the history of pop music that I can think of ever went there like that.
Yeah.
And so just, you know, hearing the song, the first time I heard it, and say, I want to fuck you like an animal, my eyebrows went up. I went, wow, okay. And he wants to make a video for this? and I got, you know, obviously very excited, because the song was already, in that sense, somewhat radical. And he wanted it to move in the popular culture. He didn't want that to be some underground thing. So it was a great opportunity to kind of go for it. I guess. And he was very supportive of that. I remember there was one discussion where I had found this very obscure painting. I don't know if I'll blank on the artist's name. I think it was George Buchner or something. And it was this woman, a naked, hairless, bald woman holding this egg spinning on her fingers. It was a small detail in a very baroque, complicated painting. And I was drawn to that image for some reason. And I said, you know, this, I said to Trent, I said, you know, in a perfect world, we would transpose this image into the video exactly as you see it. She would be fully naked. I mean, if you're having a kind of a Jungian dream, you're not going to censor yourself and put some sort of nightdress on her. And he said, well, if you think she should be naked, let's make her naked. And you got to remember that there weren't naked girls on MTV. There wasn't, you know, the art was commercialized and limited, and it would often get surreal or weird, but it would never transgress into nudity in a music video that you expected to be accepted by MTV. And I went, really? He said, yeah. I mean, we shouldn't compromise our art. If you think the girl should be naked, then let's make her naked. And I went, again, I went, okay. And I felt like he had given me license to just say, fuck all the rules, fuck all the normal kind of standards of what you want to do to be accepted. Let's just make a piece of pop art as we see fit. It was very freeing.
Yeah, and I guess once you've started to get a name for being a hugely talented director in that genre, I guess that must have been part of what got Michael Jackson and Janet Jackson calling. I mean, the difference between the vibe of Closer and the vibe of Scream and the two artists is enormous. Did you see that there was something that would connect them both? Because it feels like you've got some sort of S&M gear on Michael Jackson and Janet Jackson there, so there's parts of you in there. Did you feel like you had to compromise yourself at all to fit in that giant machine?
Well, I mean, Trent came to me because I had done a music video for Madonna, and he liked the look of the video, and he wasn't a fan of Madonna's music necessarily, but he saw something in the video. So what I try to do, and I even do this with movies, is I try to be true to the text. I try to each assignment is starting over, and if this song by Michael Jackson and Janet Jackson is about their frustrations with paparazzi and the pop media, then that's what that's about. And that's what this song, that's what I need to find images to illustrate or find images that will resonate with that idea. And then if Trent Reznor is writing a song about spirituality and sexuality, then that's what that assignment is about. And they're, I kind of start from scratch each time, almost like a tailor who's going to make a bespoke suit for somebody, And I pride myself on that, frankly, that I can do Taylor Swift, and that I could also do Jay-Z or Johnny Cash. There was a certain conscious effort to not allow myself to be pigeonholed. It wasn't really calculated, but I did see other filmmakers who had a very specific style, and they would apply that style to every song. And then what happened is I saw that they would start to go out of style. And I thought that if I didn't really have one style, that I might have more longevity, which frankly has proven to be true because, 25 years later, I'm still making music videos occasionally, and I attribute that to that kind of concept of not being able to pin me down.
Yeah, I think that's really interesting. I was going to sort of touch on it later on, but the one thing I found with your work, whether it was within a film or in music videos or commercials or whatever, is this sort of eclecticism. And I think it's fascinating because Brian De Palma, for instance, is someone who shoots sort of the psychological, sort of psychosexual thrillers, and then does The Untouchables or Mission Impossible. And even within something like 2001, it's almost like there's three different movies going on there. And I felt like as I was watching a lot of your stuff, there's a sort of, there's a big range of things. And I think it's absolutely true that it's very difficult to pigeonhole you. And I think someone looking at your range of work would go, I don't know what this guy is exactly specializing in, but I think he could do anything. Do you think that's something that's the case?
Well, like I say, I don't think I did that as a calculation. I mean, it was calculated in the sense that I didn't want to become out of style. But it was also just a natural impulse to do as many different things as I could because I just found that more interesting to do. And a little of it maybe came from Kubrick, because if you look at Kubrick, I mean, he does a black and white satire about the nuclear arms race, and then he does a period piece that's the most authentic and beautiful film about the 18th century ever made, and then he does 2001, and then he did a horror film. Like, Kubrick skipped around genres very deliberately as well, and maybe I found something appealing about that. But again, it wasn't calculated. It was just like, I just did this. I remember I had the balls once. I got a phone call from David Bowie, and he said, I love that Closer. I'd already done some videos with him, but he said, I love the Closer video. I want to do something like that for my next single. And I had the balls to say to David Bowie, who is someone I literally thought was a god walking on the earth, I said, David, I don't want to do the same thing again. I did that for Trent. I don't want to do that again. And I think he was kind of miffed that I said that. But that's the degree to which I guess I had an allergy to repeating myself.
Well, it's interesting that David Bowie would be anyway miffed, because if you look at his career, like the giant range of his own work and his own music is massive, from, you know, things like Let's Dance to Space Oddity to his recent stuff. But, you know, I guess
that's... I think he wasn't that used to people turning him down. And in some ways, of course, I regret that. Like, we certainly could have done something with a hand crank camera with David Bowie that would have been different, but I was a little cocky back then.
Yeah, there was a time, I think, in that early mid-90s period where directors like you and Spike Jones and Jonathan Glazer seemed to be really brilliant at straddling promos and commercials and eventually movies. Did you feel you were part of a kind of movement or a zeitgeist of that kind of thing?
I mean, at the time, you know, there was no question that there's something was happening that had a global reach and was very, very popular. And we were in the middle of it. I was just watching this documentary about the National Lampoon magazine with Michael O'Donohue and Doug Kenny and Henry Beard and these guys. Or when I saw the film Dogtown and Z-Boys,
yeah,
about the explosion of skate culture and how that went global. Like, it was definitely a similar thing, and you were very much aware that it was happening, for sure.
And I guess around that,
which was super exciting.
Yeah.
You know, to know that you're involved in something, because you would make a video and you knew that it was going to be serviced to, you know, 31 countries that next day. Like when you said, okay, the online is finished, you know, let's put the slate on it. This is done. I'm happy with it. It was going out globally, and then this was before the internet. So if anything was internet-like, in terms of its instant global reach, it was probably MTV, you know, before the internet.
Absolutely.
Because if you did a commercial, it was regional.
Mm.
If you did a movie, it would come out in America, and then maybe eventually it would come out in England and France and stuff, you know, many, many months later. You know, but, you know, so music videos were instantly global. And that was unique, actually.
Yeah, and you mentioned before that you hadn't ever really intended to be a promos director, and I guess there's a sort of unspoken hierarchy where sort of feature films are maybe at the top, maybe TV's coming in there now. And then, I say this as somebody who works in the industry, that commercials aren't always seen as the most prestigious thing to get into. So was that a difficult decision for you to go, I'm going to now get into commercials?
It was, actually. I really wasn't. I thought it was a bit of a sellout, and I didn't really want to do it, and didn't do it for quite a long time. And I think that increased my cachet as a commercial director, because you couldn't get me. He doesn't do those. You know, he doesn't do commercials. And then the magical thing happened that happens to a lot of people, which is I got married, I had a mortgage, I had two beautiful children, and the music, and I was tired of doing music videos, you know? And so I dipped my toe in the water of commercials and found that it wasn't too soul destroying, and started, there was like an overlap where I was making a lot of commercials and videos simultaneously. And then it sort of slowly shifted to pretty much doing commercials exclusively, or that, you know, around that time, I probably got involved with making 1 hour photo.
And the commercials that you did take on, I'm just interested, because as a creative and you send a director a script, what exactly are you looking for in a script? And has that changed over the years?
I'm always looking for a fresh idea. You know, a lot of scripts you get, wow, it's like just a variation on the same subgenre of a dozen commercials that you see, or dozens of commercials that you see, and that's not quite as interesting. So you're looking for a good advertising idea that is actually original, and most of them aren't. It evolved over the years in relation to my family, probably, and raising children, where I was less keen to travel, or at least less keen to travel outside of North America. but I'm still looking for the same thing. I'm looking for a certain amount of sincerity or authenticity or real honesty, possibly, if you can find it. And then on top of that, something that I haven't quite seen before. If you can get those two things, then it seems like it may be of some kind of value.
Yeah, and you've done several commercials, quite a lot of commercials, with brands such as Apple or Nike, almost as if you've created a relationship with those clients. Do you feel like there's a certain comfort or familiarity in working with similar people on a client that, you know, both those clients are known for creating good work? And is that something that you look for as well?
Yeah, I mean, the cliche is true. I mean, the work is as good as the client, meaning as much as the client is willing to be daring and sincere and original. You know, there's a better chance you have of making a good spot. And, you know, just there's a familiarity, which doesn't always breed contempt. There's a familiarity where, oh, you know, we've hired this guy before. He's not a total asshole. He did a great job. The commercial was successful. Let's hire him again, because let's not take a chance. Let's hire this guy again because it was a good outcome. And then, you know, everybody relaxes a little bit and you get more trust. And so it just makes for a more pleasant experience for everybody.
Sure. And yeah, as you mentioned, around that time, One Hour Photo happened. I mean, you wrote Static and One Hour Photo. I'm wondering also what your approach to screenwriting is. Is it that you feel you have something to say and you want to get that out? Or is it looking for the structure of the movie? How does that work?
Well, there's something I come back to. I mean, I certainly don't think I've only written about maybe half a dozen scripts. I don't think I have a theory or a program or a methodology that I can fall back on, because it's really hard and each story has different imperatives. But, you know, Kubrick, getting back to Kubrick again, it always makes me sound like a Kubrick fanatic, which is not really true. I mean, I hold him in esteem like most other people, but I hold him in esteem along with a dozen other master directors that are, but somehow it keeps coming back to Kubrick. He did an interview on the radio promoting Lolita, and the interviewer asked him, can you enumerate ways that you would, if you were like king of the movie business, how you would improve the movie business for filmmakers and for studios? So he came up with a list of ideas. I don't really remember any of them, but at the end of it he said, and I feel that these are some of the ways that filmmakers and studios can make films that are both more daring and more sincere. And when I heard that, it was like a bomb went off in my mind. I went, daring and sincere. Wow, that's the best description I've ever heard of what makes something good. Because it's hard to know what's good and what's bad. You know, it's all very subjective. But that was like the best crystallization of what makes something good I'd ever heard. Daring and sincere. And yeah. So that's what I look for when I'm reading scripts for commercials, or when I listen to a song to do a music video, or whether I read a script for a movie or think about writing a script, is, does this feel like an authentic expression about our human predicament? Or is it some bullshit that somebody's writing up because he thinks it'll get asses and seats? And then on top of that, is it new? Does it feel like I haven't seen it before? And if you can get those two things together, you're onto something. And so, you know, to answer your question, I guess if I'm working on a script or a movie, I'm looking for that. I'm trying to create that, which is not easy.
Absolutely. And I guess there's a bit of a gap in terms of, you know, what was involved in making Static and what was involved in making One Hour Photo. Suddenly you have a very big star, and I guess there's a lot of other people involved. Did you feel ready for One Hour Photo when it came along?
Well, I did feel ready, actually. By that time, I had probably made 100 commercials. No, maybe not that much, but probably like 70 commercials and 70 music videos, and or in many different situations and circumstances, and felt a total ease with the technical side of it. And then on the kind of storytelling and acting side of it, I took some time off and did a lot of acting classes and directing workshops with a really good teacher, and tried to develop at least a rudimentary grammar on how to work with actors and talk to actors, which is not something I've become in any way expert at all. But that allowed me to go into it with a certain amount of confidence, and also because I had written it myself, it wasn't like I had to interpret what the writer was intending. I knew what I was intending. So, and also, you know, Robin Williams is a big movie star, but I was extremely lucky in the sense that he was the greatest guy ever. And well, really easy to work with, really put me at my ease and made me feel confident and was just fun and excellent. So I had a good first experience with a big movie star. You know, and also I, you know, gotten a certain amount of experience just dealing with very charismatic stars, like, you know, having worked on these music videos with, you know, Bowie and Madonna and, you know, Mick Jagger and, you know, Madonna. I said Madonna or any, whoever.
Yeah, Trent Reznor certainly seemed to be quite a charismatic guy on the set of Closer. But I think it's also interesting that there's a... I know it's difficult to finance movies and get them made, but the gap between One Hour Photo and Never Let Me Go, was there a... You were just waiting for the right thing, or was there another reason why there was, you know, quite a long time between the two feature films there?
Yeah, I got involved in a couple of films that I spent a lot of time on that didn't end up getting made, or I left the production, or so there was a lot of, I mean, you know, with that first film, One Hour Photo, I spent probably a year traveling the world promoting it.
Oh, right.
Going to film festivals and all that kind of thing, and different markets where the film was opening. And then I started writing a script that I spent a lot of time with and still haven't made. And then I got involved in a couple of studio films that, as I said, didn't come to fruition. So I was working hard at trying to make films, but it just wasn't coming together. I think the film business was starting to really shift under our feet starting around then. And it was becoming more like it is now, which it was harder to make kind of middle-budget films. And I also was now a father of two children and was spending a good deal of time working because I worked so long on One Hour Photo. I wasn't necessarily paid a lot, and so I had to kind of replenish my bank account. So I was doing a lot of commercials, too, during that time. And I think that's around when I maybe established my relationship with Apple.
Yeah.
And I was making probably about three commercials a year just for Apple, which was almost a career unto itself.
Yeah, the Apple situation. I mean, I came in, you know, just before Steve Jobs passed away. What was it like working for that company when it was in through this sort of such a revolutionary time for itself and for the music business?
Well, it's another example of my great fortune of being in the right place at the right time. I think when I, you know, as a student, I was around for the whole '70s film revolution, and then the '80s, I was around for, in the '80s and '90s, I was around for the big kind of MTV thing, and then I think the next kind of pop culture phenomenon was really this dominance of Apple and the computers and the iPhone and the design aesthetic and the marketing aesthetic, and I was again right there for that. And I mean, the unique thing about this totally singular thing about Steve Jobs was he was running what became the largest company in the world, and he was doing it in terms of the decision making. He was doing it alone. I mean, obviously there were hundreds of, or if not thousands of people creating and designing and building this hardware and software, but it was him that was making the big decisions. And when it came to the marketing, there was no one to deal with or please besides Steve. If we were making a commercial for iTunes or one of those iPod commercials, you were making it for one guy. And he was going to say whether he liked shot three or whether we should change the edit a little bit, or it was only him. And, you know, there's never been a circumstance like that I've experienced before or since.
And when he passed away, the dynamic, you know, necessarily changed to more of a, Apple is still a unique corporation, but it became a little bit more corporate, and it became a group of people who had to have a consensus on what was the final decision. And that was the real shift in tone. Can you hear this? I'm actually in my car and it's sleeting now.
I can't hear the sleet. I'm getting a little bit of rain on my... I'm getting a bit of a shower down here as well, but I think... I can't.
We were getting pellets of ice on my car now.
Yeah, it's pretty. It's pretty epic weather at the moment. Also, in the work that's done through Apple, we have a constant conversation here about whether it's kind of story or execution that has primacy. And I guess in a great situation, you've got very strong things on both sides. But do you think that execution trumps story sometimes, and vice versa?
In what circumstance?
Well, whether it's commercials or anything like that, I mean, you can have a promo with a strong concept and narrative, or you can have something that's a little bit more of an execution piece that's a bit more visual. And if you look at the spots that were in the Silhouettes campaign, you know, you bring a huge amount to how they're executed. But in terms of the way that they're, I guess, set up as a story, it may be that the execution comes through more than the story.
Well, listen, you obviously always want both, and you want this sort of interplay between both of those things. I would rather watch a John Cassavetes movie that's on paper or objectively speaking sort of sloppily made than some slick movie that's gorgeously shot that has no impact or interest on the level of the human predicament, you know, so... I'd rather watch a poorly made film that's got a lot of heart and soul and meaning and interest than a slick, empty thing. So I think the concept is primal, is the most important thing. And even though those say, you know, I did a lot of different spots for Apple, but I did a lot of those Silhouette commercials. That was a great advertising concept, and it was a very powerful meme. And it could be, it was also very fertile in the sense that you could really go in many, many different directions with that very simple ad concept. So I think that's a great ad concept. You can't get more essential than that, that these silhouette images enjoying music and moving to music and full of life and life energy. And, it's a given that Steve wasn't going to tolerate a shoddy execution, because that's not, Apple was about, execution. Apple was about that story that Steve told about his father, wanting to get the back of the fence painted well. And Steve said, well, no one's going to see the back of the fence. And his father said, well, we'll know, And so, you applied that to filmmaking. I use the word Steve, like we were buddies. Like I met him once, and spoke to him on the phone once or twice, and traded emails with him a few times, but it wasn't like I knew the guy very well. But you were always aware that you were making it for Steve, and Steve would have notes, and the notes would come back, and it was all about pleasing him.
And going back to the daring and sincere part that Kubrick said, obviously there's a lot of that in Never Let Me Go. Did you come to the book first, or did they come to you? How did that begin?
Fan of Ishiguro's, and I read everything that he wrote, and I remember when that book came out, I bought it the week it came out and read it and loved it and was moved to tears by it and couldn't let it go, no pun intended. And that's true of a lot of Ishiguro's books. They really stick in the craw of your subconscious. And so then I read it again, and it was interesting to read it again, knowing the kind of the secrets of the book. I think I wanted to work backwards from knowing the secrets. And so I loved the book, and I immediately checked on the rights and was told that they were taken. And so then I sort of put it out of my mind. And I don't know how much longer, maybe a year later or something, I got a call from Peter Rice, who was running Fox Searchlight, where I made One Hour Photo. And he said, have you ever heard of a book called Never Let Me Go? And I go, yeah. Cautiously, I went, yeah. He said, well, did you like it? I said, yeah. He said, would you be interested in being considered to make a film of it? And I went, yeah, that's pretty much my favorite book of the last 10 years. So it was a great phone call. And I had to fly to England to meet with the producers and Alex Garland, who wrote the script, and pretty much auditioned for it. And I guess they liked what I said, but they were all a little predisposed to me, because I think Peter Rice said, if you like this guy, I'll green light a movie with this guy. Yeah. I had a really good good experience with him. And I guess I said the right things in the meeting, and as unlikely as it may seem, they, in some ways, as an American, and it was a very delicate film, and people don't necessarily think of music video and commercial directors as doing delicate work. But I got the job, and it was a great experience. Really, I was thrilled to be doing it because I loved the material so ardently.
Yeah, I have to say, as an English person, that you captured England really beautifully there in a way that, if I hadn't known you were American, I would have imagined immediately that you must be English, because there are so many nuances in particularly the school sequences at the beginning that you've really, captured so well. Did you have any kind of, I wouldn't say assistance with that, or was that something that you kind of were able to drive yourself?
Well, I definitely had a ton of assistance, but I was kind of an Anglophile for a long time. I fell in love with England through Monty Python, I think. And to some extent, the Kubrick films, which have a kind of an Englishness, kind of suffused in an Englishness, even if they're not supposed to take place in England. And then I did a semester abroad and spent about 6 months living in London. And then after college, I went back and lived in London for, I think, about 2 years after school. I kind of just hung out in London. So I just liked, I was kind of an Anglophile, I guess. But that's not saying that I was an expert on the details of English boarding school life. So, I had a lot of help, and it was an all-English crew. It was really me and the cinematographer, the only Americans. And, if I was getting something off the mark, or if I suggested something that was inauthentic, I was certainly alerted to that fact. So I had a lot of help. But I also think there's a quality of an outsider can almost see the culture in a clearer way or a more objective way. I remember when I saw the Ang Lee film, The Ice Storm.
Yeah.
That was my childhood. That was my 70s suburban American childhood. And I thought it was like phenomenally accurate. And he's from, Taiwan or something.
Yeah.
So I guess that happens sometimes, where an outsider can see the culture more clearly.
Yep. I guess we're getting a bit close to the present day now. So do you have things that you're still trying to fit into your career, new directions you want to go in, or is there another movie on the horizon?
Yeah, I'm happy and grateful to be able to make commercials, because it's a good job, and it's an interesting job, and it pays well, and I can pay for my life. But, still only really want to be a feature film director. If I could manipulate and navigate my career with any autonomy, I would navigate it to be able to survive just making films. I'm working on a couple of films. There's a David Mamet script, an original David Mamet script that I'm trying to get financed. And there's another film that's kind of like a dramedy, how do you say that? That is pretty out of keeping with what you would imagine I would be interested in, because the two films I've done so far, just coincidentally in a way, are the ones that I was able to get greenlit, who happened to be kind of dark. But this one has a light touch. So in reference to what we were talking about before of trying not to be pigeonholed, I'm excited about making this sort of lighter, more comedic film.
Well, I'd really look forward to it. And I think a lot of other people would as well. So just wanted to say thanks again for spending the time to talk to me. It's been really fantastic to really find out all the stuff that's happened behind your career. And yeah, thanks a lot, Mark.
Oh yeah, thank you. Thanks for having any interest. it's been enjoyable talking to you.
Great. I'll send you a link to the final one. I've got a bit of a backlog, so it'll probably be about a month's time. But yeah, thanks a lot and enjoy the rest of your Monday.
Cool. Thanks so much. Have a good day.
Okay. Thanks, Mark. Bye.
See ya. Bye.
The worst question.